Not a good song. Thank you guys so much. An original they wrote. Phenomenal. Great, great stuff. And they probably want to know what happened with the Beans and Rice Fest, huh? Yes, you do want to know. Yes. All right. Well, let's give ourselves a little bit of perspective here. First of all, we had invested, since we're on an ROI series, we had invested about $10,000 in this experiment. This was the startup cost. This was technology cost. This was staff time. A total investment of about $10,000, everything, to go after three amazing initiatives, helping kids with Compassion International, who have been dropped and were now hungry, not getting education, opening up city pools on the weekend that would normally be shut down, and then giving scholarships for preschool, because $1 put in preschool education in our city saves the city $300 long term. So what we had to do is figure out, well, what do we think that might happen? So as we talked to these organizations, we were able to say, okay, if it was this much, what could you do? If it's this much, what could we do? We had to do some internal planning. And so we had an internal hope that this $10,000 would turn into $150,000. That's what we were hoping for. So we were hoping that we would have a return on investment of, oh, I don't know what that is, tenfold, 17, that's too small. Let me use a big one. And actually try to fill up an internal desire to have all of these initiatives taken care of. Gosh, this is taking a long time. Let me try something else here. All of these initiatives just helped and gone to the next place. Now, here's the good news, and here's the news here. That 150, we didn't get the 150,000. We got more than 150,000. Yes, we do. We got more than that. We had 200,000. Wasn't 200,000, it was more than that. It was more than 250,000, more than 300,000, more than $377,000. Are you freaking kidding me? That is amazing and astounding. Amazing and astounding. Now, based on your faithfulness, we estimate about half of Crossroads did this. Based on your ability to step up, not only are we able to do all the things that we talked about before, but more funny money towards the Compassion International Fund. We're actually not just able to keep open all those pools, we're actually able to give scholarships so kids can actually go. They wouldn't afford to be able to go to that pool. We actually are going to be able to do swim lessons for over 300 kids. Over 300 kids. Honestly, I mean, the return on investment is such that, I mean, shoot, I don't know. We may have kept kids alive who aren't going to drown because they can swim now. And because he's so generous, Chuck Mingo has decided he's a good swimmer. He's going to help them understand how to put on a Speedo. He does a really good job with that. And you can check that out. As it relates to, that's good fun right there. That's just good stuff. As it relates to the preschool initiative, here's the weird thing. Every dollar, as I said, is $300 later on. We basically have invested in the city $45 million. How can we actually measure how many families will be healthier? I mean, it's great. Well, well done. We have some thankfulness from the organizations that we're sending all the money that was given incremental. By the way, our offering last week was the same offering it always is. So this was all incremental giving. Way to go. Way to go. Let's take a look at some short little thank you videos from people who were helping.
Hi, I'm Mayor Mark Mallory, and I just want to take this opportunity to thank the Crossroads community for your investment of $65,000 in Cincinnati's young people. You know, this money is going to allow us to make sure that young people can swim in the summer on Sundays and also extended hours. And it's this kind of investment that really lets me know that Crossroads is committed to the city of Cincinnati and the greater community. So again, thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Greg Lansman, and I'm the executive director of the Stripe Partnership. We want to thank you for your incredibly generous investment in expanding quality preschool for children throughout our region. It will make a huge difference in their lives And for that, we are incredibly grateful. Quality preschool matters. There's sufficient data from our wonderful partners at United Way, Success by Six, 4C for Children, others, to confirm that this really works, that this is one of the best returns on investment if we can just support what you all have done, which is to expand quality preschool. We will have improved outcomes for kids in dramatic ways. So from really the bottom of our hearts, thank you so much for your incredibly generous investment and all that you're doing to prioritize preschool and make this a reality for more kids throughout our region. Thank you.
Hey, Crossroads Church. This is Justin Segoyan. I'm the National Director of Church Relations for Compassion International. And I just want to send you a quick message thanking you for the donation you gave towards our unsponsored children's fund. You know, a lot of people consider that fund maybe not something really attractive or sexy to give to, but you guys stepped up and what you did is you closed the gap for these kids. As they're waiting for a sponsor, they're now going to get the nutritional encouragement and development that they're going to need. They're going to get the education they need. They're going to get introduced to Jesus, all because you guys stepped up and, as I said, filled that gap for them while they're waiting for that sponsor. So thank you so much for all you're doing. And as far as I'm concerned, man, you guys are the greatest thing to come out of Cincinnati since the Icky Shuffle in the 1980s. Take care. Thanks so much. And we're proud to partner with you. God bless.
Oh, man. It's so good. It's just so good. One of the things it reminds me of is the book of First Chronicles. It talks about what ancient people of God did that we should be doing right now. It says this in chapter 29. Then the people rejoice because they had given willingly, for with a whole heart they had offered freely to the Lord. We gave willingly, relatively mildly. I mean, I don't think anybody went hungry. No one really was in pain this last week, I don't think. Some people didn't do beans and rice. They instead just decided to eat what was in their pantry for a week. Some decided to pull money from savings or this. It was an amazing, whatever you did, man, you just need to feel great and rejoice. Let's thank everybody who actually honored God and did this. Way to go, an honoring. Today we're going to talk a lot about numbers. You can't talk about return on investment without talking about numbers. And some of us feel that numbers are unspiritual. That's not true. If you feel that, you're going to have a hard time with all of today. Numbers are not only spiritual, they're not only practical, they're actually biblical. The Bible is filled with number after number after number. In fact, there's a whole book in the Bible called Numbers. Boy, a lot of you, yes. A whole book in the Bible called Numbers. It's constantly numbering the nation of Israel, numbering how many warriors, numbering how many tribes, numbering how many disciples Jesus has, numbering how many people are actually coming to faith. It's like every time someone's counting. Let's see. Well, you count all the time in the book of Acts, chapter 4, verse 4. It says this. But many of those who had heard the word believed, and the number of the men came to about 5,000. I mean, numbers are all throughout the scriptures. And in fact, anytime you're concerned about a return on investment, you're concerned about numerical data. Now, sometimes the numerical data can't speak to what's happening. I mean, Crossroads, we take up numbers. Last week, we had 20,554 people in attendance at all three sites. That's less than the Super Bowl was. People like Super Bowl more than Easter, I guess, or Super Bowl service. But, you know, the numbers can't tell us. I have no idea. I mean, how many marriages are still together as a result of being a part of a healthy church? I don't know. How many kids actually have a heart that's formed towards Jesus as a result of what's happening in Kids Club and elsewhere? I don't know. I mean, how many people have overcome addictions, go to sleep at night with a sense of hope, respond to a critical word at work with a word of love because there's a mature... We can't count those things. But nonetheless, numbers do tell part of a story. I ran across a video a couple weeks ago that I've shown to others 5, 6, 7 times. Every time I see something interesting in it, and I think it's something all of us who are part of Crossroads would benefit to see. It's a longer video. It's maybe the longest video we've ever shown, unless you're in Florence or Mason. Then you see a 35-minute video every single week. But it's really profound and really critical for us. And as we take a look at this, we're also going to have the opportunity to be generous and to give. Some of us give through our mobile giving app, which is increasing in popularity, or e-gift or one-time gifts online. Some of us like the tactile way of writing out a check or dropping in a wad of cash. Whatever you want to do, that's great. If you're newer today, we know you're a bit freaked out. It's going to get worse for you today. It is. So we're excited you're here. Feel free to let that pass you by as you see what this place is about. Check this out.
The real social innovation I want to talk about involves charity. I want to talk about how the things we've been taught to think about giving and about charity and about the nonprofit sector are actually undermining the causes we love and our profound yearning to change the world. But before I do that, I want to ask if we even believe that the nonprofit sector has any serious role to play in changing the world. A lot of people say now that business will lift up the developing economies and social business will take care of the rest. And I do believe that business will move the great mass of humanity forward. But it always leaves behind that 10% or more that is most disadvantaged or unlucky. And social business needs markets, and there are some issues for which you just can't develop the kind of money measures that you need for a market. I sit on the board of a center for the developmentally disabled. And these people want laughter and compassion, and they want love. How do you monetize that? And that's where the nonprofit sector and philanthropy come in. Philanthropy is the market for love. It is the market for all those people for whom there is no other market coming. And so if we really want, like Buckminster Fuller said, a world that works for everyone, with no one and nothing left out, then the nonprofit sector has to be a serious part of the conversation. But it doesn't seem to be working. Why have our breast cancer charities not come close to finding a cure for breast cancer, or our homeless charities not come close to ending homelessness in any major city? Why has poverty remained stuck at 12% of the U.S. population for 40 years? And the answer is, these social problems are massive in scale, our organizations are tiny up against them, and we have a belief system that keeps them tiny. We have two rule books. We have one for the nonprofit sector and one for the rest of the economic world. It's an apartheid, and it discriminates against the nonprofit sector in five different areas, the first being compensation. So in the for-profit sector, the more value you produce, the more money you can make. But we don't like nonprofits to use money to incentivize people to produce more in social service. We have a visceral reaction to the idea that anyone would make very much money helping other people. Interesting that we don't have a visceral reaction to the notion that people would make a lot of money not helping other people. You know, you want to make $50 million selling violent video games to kids, go for it. We'll put you on the cover of Wired magazine. But you want to make $500,000 trying to cure kids of malaria, and you're considered a parasite yourself. And we think of this as our system of ethics, but what we don't realize is that this system has a powerful side effect, which is it gives a really stark, mutually exclusive choice between doing very well for yourself and your family or doing good for the world to the brightest minds coming out of our best universities, and sends tens of thousands of people who could make a huge difference in the nonprofit sector marching every year directly into the for-profit sector because they're not willing to make that kind of lifelong economic sacrifice. Business Week did a survey, looked at the compensation packages for MBAs 10 years out of business school. And the median compensation for a Stanford MBA with bonus at the age of 38 was $400,000. Meanwhile, for the same year, the average salary for the CEO of a $5 million plus medical charity in the US was $232,000, and for a hunger charity, $84,000. Now, there's no way you're going to get a lot of people with $400,000 talent to make a $316,000 sacrifice every year to become the CEO of a hunger charity. Some people say, well, that's just because those MBA types are greedy. Not necessarily. They might be smart. It's cheaper for that person to donate $100,000 every year to the hunger charity, save $50,000 on their taxes, so still be roughly $270,000 a year ahead of the game, now be called a philanthropist because they donated $100,000 to charity, probably sit on the board of the Hunger Charity, indeed probably supervise the poor SOB who decided to become the CEO of the Hunger Charity, and have a lifetime of this kind of power and influence and popular praise still ahead of them. The second area of discrimination is advertising and marketing. So we tell the for-profit sector, spend, spend, spend on advertising until the last dollar no longer produces a penny of value. But we don't like to see our donations spent on advertising and charity. Our attitude is, well, look, if you can get the advertising donated, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm okay with that. But I don't want my donation spent on advertising. I want it to go to the needy. As if the money invested in advertising could not bring in dramatically greater sums of money to serve the needy. In the 1990s, my company created the long-distance AIDS ride bicycle journeys and 60-mile-long breast cancer three-day walks. And over the course of 9 years, we had 182,000 ordinary heroes participate, and they raised a total of $581 million. They raised more money more quickly for these causes than any events in history, all based on the idea that people are weary of being asked to do the least they can possibly do. People are yearning to measure the full distance of their potential on behalf of the causes that they care about deeply. But they have to be asked. We got that many people to participate by buying full-page ads in the New York Times and the Boston Globe and primetime radio and TV advertising. Do you know how many people we would have gotten if we put up flyers in the laundromat? Charitable giving has remained stuck in the U.S. at 2% of GDP ever since we started measuring it in the 1970s. That's an important fact because it tells us that in 40 years, the nonprofit sector has not been able to wrestle any market share away from the for-profit sector. And if you think about it, how could one sector possibly take market share away from another sector if it isn't really allowed to market? And if we tell the consumer brands, you may advertise all the benefits of your product, but we tell charities, you cannot advertise all the good that you do, where do we think the consumer dollars are going to flow? The third area of discrimination is the taking of risk in pursuit of new ideas for generating revenue. So Disney can make a new $200 million movie that flops, and nobody calls the Attorney General. But you do a little $1 million community fundraiser for the poor, and it doesn't produce a 75% profit to the cause in the first 12 months, and your character's called into question. So nonprofits are really reluctant to attempt any brave, daring, giant-scale new fundraising endeavors for fear that if the thing fails, their reputations will be dragged through the mud. Well, you and I know when you prohibit failure, you kill innovation. If you kill innovation in fundraising, you can't raise more revenue. If you can't raise more revenue, you can't grow. And if you can't grow, you can't possibly solve large social problems. The fourth area is time. So Amazon went for 6 years without returning any profit to investors, and people had patience. They knew that there was a long-term objective down the line of building market dominance. But if a nonprofit organization ever had a dream of building magnificent scale that required that for 6 years, no money was going to go to the needy, it was all going to be invested in building this scale, we would expect a crucifixion. And the last area is profit itself. So the for-profit sector can pay people profits in order to attract their capital for their new ideas, but you can't pay profits in a non-profit sector. So the for-profit sector has a lock on the multi-trillion dollar capital markets, and the non-profit sector is starved for growth and risk and idea capital. Well, you put those five things together, you can't use money to lure talent away from the for-profit sector, you can't advertise on anywhere near the scale the for-profit sector does for new customers, you can't take the kinds of risks in pursuit of those customers that the for-profit sector takes, you don't have the same amount of time to find them as the for-profit sector, and you don't have a stock market with which to fund any of this, even if you could do it in the first place, and you've just put the nonprofit sector at an extreme disadvantage to the for-profit sector on every level. If we have any doubts about the effects of this separate rulebook, this statistic is sobering. From 1970 to 2009, the number of nonprofits that really grew, that crossed the $50 million annual revenue barrier, is 144. In the same time, the number of for-profits that crossed it is 46,136. So we're dealing with social problems that are massive in scale, and our organizations can't generate any scale. All of the scale goes to Coca-Cola and Burger King. So why do we think this way? Well, like most fanatical dogma in America, these ideas come from old Puritan beliefs. The Puritans came here for religious reasons, or so they said, but they also came here because they wanted to make a lot of money. They were pious people, but they were also really aggressive capitalists. And they were accused of extreme forms of profit-making tendencies compared to the other colonists. But at the same time, the Puritans were Calvinists. So they were taught literally to hate themselves. They were taught that self-interest was a raging sea that was a sure path to eternal damnation. Well, this created a real problem for these people, right? Here they've come all the way across the Atlantic to make all this money. Making all this money will get you sent directly to hell. What were they to do about this? Well, charity became their answer. It became this economic sanctuary where they could do penance for their profit-making tendencies at 5 cents on the dollar. So, of course, how could you make money in charity if charity was your penance for making money? Financial incentive was exiled from the realm of helping others so that it could thrive in the area of making money for yourself. And in 400 years, nothing has intervened to say that's counterproductive and that's unfair. Now, this ideology gets policed by this one very dangerous question, which is what percentage of my donation goes to the cause versus overhead? There are a lot of problems with this question. I'm going to just focus on two. First, it makes us think that overhead is a negative, that it is somehow not part of the cause. But it absolutely is, especially if it's being used for growth. Now, this idea that overhead is somehow an enemy of the cause creates the second much larger problem, which is it forces organizations to go without the overhead things they really need to grow in the interest of keeping overhead low. So we've all been taught that charities should spend as little as possible on overhead things like fundraising under the theory that, well, the less money you spend on fundraising, the more money there is available for the cause. Well, that's true if it's a depressing world in which this pie cannot be made any bigger. But if it's a logical world in which investment in fundraising actually raises more funds and makes the pie bigger, then we have it precisely backwards, and we should be investing more money, not less, in fundraising, because fundraising is the one thing that has the potential to multiply the amount of money available for the cause that we care about so deeply. I'll give you two examples. We launched the AIDS Rides with an initial investment of $50,000 in risk capital. Within 9 years, we had multiplied that 1,982 times into $108 million after all expenses for AIDS services. We launched the Breast Cancer 3 Days with an initial investment of $350,000 in risk capital. Within just 5 years, we had multiplied that 554 times into $194 million after all expenses for breast cancer research. Now, if you were a philanthropist really interested in breast cancer, what would make more sense? Go out and find the most innovative researcher in the world and give her $350,000 for research, or give her fundraising department the $350,000 to multiply it into $194 million for breast cancer research. 2002 was our most successful year ever. We netted for breast cancer alone, that year alone, $71 million after all expenses. And then we went out of business, suddenly and traumatically. Why? Well, the short story is our sponsor split on us. They wanted to distance themselves from us because we were being crucified in the media for investing 40% of the gross in recruitment and customer service and the magic of the experience. And there is no accounting terminology to describe that kind of investment in growth and in the future other than this demonic label of overhead. So on one day, all 350 of our great employees lost their jobs because they were labeled overhead. Our sponsor went and tried the events on their own. The overhead went up. Net income for breast cancer research went down by 84% or $60 million in 1 year. This is what happens when we confuse morality with frugality. We've all been taught that the bake sale with 5% overhead is morally superior to the professional fundraising enterprise with 40% overhead. But we're missing the most important piece of information, which is, what is the actual size of these pies? Who cares if the bake sale only has 5% overhead if it's tiny? What if the bake sale only netted $71 for charity because it made no investment in its scale and the professional fundraising enterprise netted $71 million because it did? Now, which pie would we prefer, and which pie do we think people who are hungry would prefer? Here's how all of this impacts the big picture. I said that charitable giving is 2% of GDP in the United States. That's about $300 billion a year. But if we could move charitable giving from 2% of GDP up just one step to 3% of GDP by investing in that growth, that would be an extra $150 billion a year in contributions. And if that money could go disproportionately to health and human services charities, because those were the ones we encouraged to invest in their growth, that would represent a tripling of contributions to that sector. Now we're talking scale. Now we're talking the potential for real change. But it's never going to happen by forcing these organizations to lower their horizons to the demoralizing objective of keeping their overhead low. Our generation does not want its epitaph to read, "We kept charity overhead low." We want it to read that we changed the world, and that part of the way we did that was by changing the way we think about these things. So the next time you're looking at a charity, don't ask about the rate of their overhead. Ask about the scale of their dreams. Their Apple, Google, Amazon scale dreams, how they measure their progress toward those dreams, and what resources they need to make them come true, regardless of what the overhead is. Who cares what the overhead is if these problems are actually getting solved? If we can have that kind of generosity, a generosity of thought, then the nonprofit sector can play a massive role in changing the world for all those citizens most desperately in need of it to change.
Interesting. I felt like we were able to handle that at this point on week 5. Really good stuff that challenges some of our assumptions. And today, the rest of our time, we're going to put on our big boy pants. We're going to put on our big boy pants, and we're going to think critically, spiritually, biblically, and practically about what that kind of information means to our personal life and our city. What this means to our future as a church. You know, if you were to take a look at Crossroads, if someone's going to invest in Crossroads, which any of us who give, we have basically invested in the things that God has given us to put into our local church. And we would have to say, what is the return on investment? We have to look at these. These numbers are important. 1996, actually 1995, when Libby and I were invited to start Crossroads by 11 people, we had a very simple mission. We want to connect seekers to a community of growing Christ followers. We want to take people who are outside of going to church anywhere, bring them into an environment where they can interact with people who had a relationship with Jesus, and all of us grow spiritually as we went along. So we started using the term from that video, I haven't thought of before, risk capital. We had $50,000 of risk capital, which was just the regular tithes that those 11 people have been paying into a fund for a period of time before I came to Crossroads. We took that $50,000, and in 1996, we started March of 96. We had giving that year of $200,000. Our average attendance was 300 people, and the lives affected outside of it was 1,130. These are very rough and very conservative estimates on the lives affected outside. This has been people who we were tutoring, people we were serving in local hunger kitchens, those kinds of things. 5 years forward to 2001, you would see our giving at $4.5 million. Our average attendance is 3,100 roughly, and lives affected outside continues to grow, 65, 85. Again, this doesn't quantify who's still married that would be divorced. It doesn't quantify who's still alive because they have hope and didn't commit a suicide. Who is still, you know, having a more fulfilling and joyful life because they're connected with their creator. Numbers can't show that. Then the next slide shows us that in 2006, we went to a bigger vision. We said, we're getting all of these people. What happens if we now say, man, God has blessed us with people. It's not just growing Crossroads more and more and more. We need to mobilize people to be a blessing to our city, be a blessing to the world. This is where we got really serious about CityLink. We said, no, we're in, and we're going to put millions into it. We're going to make it happen. So we started getting serious about South Africa. This is where we started taking WizKids to the next level, and who are changing the world, not just coming together and congregating and doing some one-off service project, but who are actually changing the world. That year, 2006, we saw our annual giving of $9.2 million. Our attendance was 8,285, average attendance, and lives affected outside of us was 40,470. If you go to 2011, 2012, actually, giving was $26 million. So our normal game change giving and our ministry fund giving. Average attendance is 15,886, and lives affected is over 175,000 people outside of Crossroads. Now, when you look at that over 17 years, that shows a return on investment that is virtually unprecedented. It shows a return on investment that is crazy. Isn't God good that he includes us in this? Isn't he good that we get to see? No, guess what? You've never known anyone to be a part of something like this before. Well, I do. There's one church in Chicago that I got the idea from. They did 6 years ago. We did it better. You don't know any group of people that ever did what we just did through God's power. God, you don't know any vision that ever took place like that. And 1 week, bam, we adjusted very little about our lives. Very little. Only half of us said very little. As of Tuesday, the largest check was $1,000. Hey, here's a weird thing. You like how that feels? You like kids swimming and, you know, here's a little secret. We could have this every week. Every week. The redemptive potential here is astronomical. We have Google, Amazon-sized visions here. We do. We don't just want to grow Crossroads, grow more sites. We want to see a city substantively change. We're having discussions in our senior level of leaders right now. What is the long-term future of Crossroads? Where are we going? And Malcolm Gladwell, a number of years ago, had a book out called The Tipping Point, where he looks at how movements tip and affect entire societies. And we figured that the tipping point for Cincinnati to become a substantively different city is 250,000 people all about that mission. And so we're right now praying, planning, strategizing, brainstorming, asking God to give us ideas. What would it look like to have a Crossroads of 250,000 people? And that might not be 250,000 inside sites of Crossroads. That could be official links that we have with other churches. We're actually doing the same thing. Could be other kind of organizations we start. Could be other underground things that take place to the arts community, to the business community. Jesus said, greater things will you do. That's what he said to his followers, which we're on the downline of those followers. He said, greater things will you do. Jesus never saw a city substantively and functionally changed. We are going to see a city functionally and substantively changed. I believe in our lifetime, you will see a city that people will be looking at from around the world going, whatever happened there, we need that happen in our city. Whatever happened there to bring the crime rate down, to bring the poverty rate down, to bring the sex rate in marriage up, to bring the arts level up, to bring all, whatever happened there needs to happen here. Now, if you're 80, I'm sorry, you're not going to see it. I'm sorry. I don't know what the cutoff is, but I'm very confident if you're 80, you're not going to see it. Probably not even 70. Sorry, but these are the dreams we feel like God is, maybe even 60. These are the dreams we feel God has birthed in us. And we feel like we need to give him a return and honor him for the things that he's inviting us, including. Isn't this fun? Isn't that fun? The book of Proverbs, chapter 11, verse 10 says that when the righteous prosper, the city rejoices. We're finding increasing people in our city that are rejoicing over Crossroads prosperity because we were having a disproportional impact on the welfare of our city. Well done. Well done. Way to go. You get to be a part of something that many people would love to be a part of but are not able to. Now, the rest of our time here today, I'm going to look at one of Jesus' teachings, which is a pretty profound teaching and relevant for today. In it, he categorizes people. Jesus apparently loves to categorize people. And he gives a parable which everybody in here fits very snugly in one of four categories. It's called the parable of the soils. I'm going to read the Mark 4 version, and here's what it says. Again, he began to teach beside the sea, and a very large crowd. There's more numbers, more noticing growth. Doesn't give the exact duplicate number here, but it calls it out. And a very large crowd gathered about him so that he got into a boat and sat it on the sea. And the whole crowd was beside the sea on the land. And he was teaching them many things in parables. And in his teaching, he said to them, "Listen, behold, a sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seed fell along the path, and the birds came and devoured it. Other seed fell on rocky ground, where it did not have much soil, and immediately it sprang up, since it had no depth of soil. And when the sun rose, it was scorched, and since it had no root, it withered away. Other seed fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no grain. And other seeds fell into good soil and produced grain, growing up and increasing and yielding 30-fold and 60-fold and 100-fold. And he said, and he says to us right now, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." I believe Jesus is saying to us right now, he and she who has ears to hear, let him hear. Jesus categorizes all of us in one of four categories. The first category is happens as the sower is going out and sowing seed. The sower represents God. The sower represents God, and the seed represents any truth that God has. Anything God gives us, it is a seed. And we get this idea of the seed being scattered, and the seed falls in one of four places. The first place that God's truth, God's understanding comes, which it could come from reading the Bible, could come from an environment like this, could come from a word that somebody gives us that is definitely something God agrees with us, could come from a feeling that God is giving us. The first and most, maybe most common, Jesus doesn't say that, but maybe it is when God's truth comes, it falls on the path, and the seed on the path is the well-worn attitudes that cause Jesus' teaching to be rejected. The path is where everybody goes. The path is, and why the path? Because it's, you know, it's the easiest way to go. It's the shortest distance between two. It's the path. And so when we are likened to the path, these are people who, when the seed comes and hits our hearts, hits our ears, birds come. Before it can germinate, before it can settle into the dirt, birds come. Birds come and pluck off the seed. Birds pluck off the seed out of our hearts. So it goes into our ears, comes in before anything can happen. Bird comes, takes it away. Everything is the same. No crop, no harvest, no anything. So if you are normal, if you are like other people, your attitudes about marriage, your attitudes about finance, you are likely the seed on the path because it's the well-worn place that makes sense to other people but never produces a harvest. Oftentimes I hear things like, where does Crossroads, where's all the money go at Crossroads? When I hear that, I hear, "Gah! Gah! Gah!" I go, "What do you mean, where's all the money?" Dude, we show it all the time where it goes. We have an annual report you can pick up out at the information center. It shows where every dollar went last year. We have an external audit of our books, and this last year we had a stellar rating yet again. You can call the office and ask about it. I never understand. But see, that's what the evil one does. Messages like this come down, goes on our heart like, "Well, I couldn't, how much does that guy make? Gah! Gah! Gah!" Gosh, they're always talking about money. We talk, why? Gah! Gah! I'm going to go to my chiropractor this week. My goodness. Staff costs. Some people say, "Gosh, $5,000 in staff costs in this? What's going on?" Yeah. We have 115 staff members here at Crossroads. As volunteer intensive as we are, you cannot do the things we're doing without infrastructure. It cannot happen. That's why this doesn't happen anywhere else that you've ever heard of. Nowhere. You must have infrastructure and scale. Interesting, our staff makes up 1% of our total attendance, which is very, very small. Very, very small. And here's a cool thing I love about our staff. Our staff who builds into us and helps us do what we need to do accounts for 4% of Crossroads total giving. 1% counts for, now I'm not talking about board, I'm talking about the staff. You have an amazing staff who loves you and serves you and serves God, most importantly. And our staff members, in many, many, many cases, took significant pay cuts to be able to come on staff. Our management team, people who report directly to me, If I figured out our management team alone probably left $4 million a year in annual salary on the table, leaving what they were doing to come here and serve God and honor Him. We have to start thinking differently if we want different results. If we want the same results we've always had, let's keep walking the same paths everyone else has worn and having zero impact. Who doesn't talk about wanting to change the world? Gosh, every top 40 song seems to talk about it. You can't sing about it unless you receive what God does and you allow it to produce something in our hearts. The second place where God's word falls is on rocky ground. Rocky ground is well-intentioned ideas that aren't rooted. So the seed hits us. We go, oh, I'm interesting. Okay, so it's on immediate rejection, hits us, but there's no rootedness to it, so therefore it can't go. You know, my rootedness in everything I want to do of importance in my life is the identity of Jesus. My rootedness is the character of God. I never want to depend on motivational things to get me to do X or Y. I'll take motivational things, wonderful. My rootedness is in the character of God. And my heavenly daddy is a generous daddy. And he's given me abundantly, and I want to be like him. I want to be generous. That's the main thing everybody who produces for God does. We're rooted in that identity, not based on anything else other than his character. And then beyond that, we need to actually have disciplines. Sometimes things don't take root because we say, yeah, I want to do that, but we don't start any repeatable disciplines. One of the things I'm ashamed about for myself is Libby and I have been married for over 25 years, and one of the things we've never gotten right, and it's, I think, maybe mainly my responsibility, is we never have really done well on praying together regularly and consistently. We'll pray individually, and we'll pray as some unique need arises, but there's never been any regular rhythm of praying together. I find it's very common with couples. I have a bunch of theories on that. I'm not going to share that right now. But finally, not too long ago, we said, gosh, we need a repeatable system we're going to commit ourselves to. And so we just said Saturday mornings. We're sitting having coffee on the couch. Let's just pray. It's not like it's not some two-hour thing. It's not even an hour thing. It's just say, and let's pray. And I'll tell you, just having an identifiable, repeatable system has brought fruit for us. Everything in my life that I've grown in, anything in my life that God's done in me, it's come from identifying a repeatable system that can cause roots. One of the reasons why we don't grow in our giving, and if we don't grow in our giving, we can't grow in our redemptive potential as a church. We cannot. Is that we don't establish any sort of system, any sort of discipline that dictates it. The well-worn path says, well, just wait till the end of the year and see what your tax bill, how much money you have left over in savings, and figure out how you want to cut it down. That path doesn't change anything. Maybe your tax bill, though, it doesn't change anything. One of the systems that we're going to encourage you to do next week and this week to think about it is to actually have a premeditated percentage of your income that you give away. Premeditated. Think about it ahead of time. Meditate on it. Think about it. Pray on it. Consider it. And then have it be in proportion to what you're actually making. In the Bible, one of the premeditated percentages that's talked about is the tithe, the 10%. Sort of, if you will, the gold standard for people who are in love with God. In the book of Malachi, chapter 3, verse 10, it puts it this way. Bring the full tithe into the storehouse that there may be food in my house, and thereby put me to the test, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open the windows of heaven for you and pour down for you a blessing until there is no more need. This is the only time in the Bible where God says, hey, why don't you invest in my principles? In fact, if you do it, I will promise you that you won't regret it. It's the only time God says, test me. The only time in the entire Bible that I'm aware of. I've never known anybody that had a premeditated percentage of 10% going outside themselves that has ever regretted, ever. I don't know any. Of course, proportionally, I don't know many people who actually do it. I know a bunch, but proportionally, not a lot who say they love God. I haven't seen that. But God isn't even just saying here, I'm going to meet your needs. He actually forms you spiritually. You have less love for money, so you have, therefore, less materialism and less impulse. It's an amazing blessing. I want to encourage you this week to think through what is a preset percentage that you might want to think about. 10% is a wonderful gold standard, but it's also a place where for many of our faith isn't big enough to take God's word at that right now. Maybe you just want to pick a percentage and grow it from there. Maybe you want to say 4%. I'm going to pre-met 4%. Maybe it's 3%. Maybe it's 6%. And then, as a part of your spiritual growth plan, rootedness, you grow it by 1% every single year. Lib and I, we blew by the tithe a long time ago, and we regularly think these things through. Some of us are going to come in next week, and we're going to be able to actually declare what's there. Many of us are just going to declare what we've already been doing because we know God is very, very pleased with that. Others of us, for the first time, are just noticing, wow, I would like a better return, and I want to root myself in some discipline that creates more of this love. The second or the third category that Jesus talks about is the thorny ground. Thorny ground. Thorny ground are well-formed actions that are choked by unchecked issues. So the seed comes in, and what do you know? It takes root, and it starts growing up. But simultaneously to it growing up, there's another thing that's growing side by side, and eventually it encroaches over on it and chokes it out. So last week we had a great time nailing ourselves up on the cross, our debts. We felt this sense of forgiveness, many of us did. It was just a beautiful spirit in the air. And we went out maybe on a spiritual high. And when you went out, based on what you exposed yourself to or what you did that day, you could have totally killed your spiritual buzz. Because it was a thorn that choked it out. So thorns are things on our not-to-do list. We can't add anything to our to-do list without putting something on the not-to-do list. So oftentimes we have a giving goal. Okay, I want to go to this percent. But we have to at the same time say, how will that affect this over here? So if we self-medicate through shopping, we won't be able to increase our giving if we self-medicate through shopping. We have to recognize this is a thorn I have to handle. Some of us might have to say, well, I'm going to have to change this, less of that. Or some of us, for the first time, maybe thinking how money works and dividing things. Maybe the unchecked issue of simply, for the first time we have a budget, we realize we manage our money better. My goodness, I can't even sense a discernible difference in my life. Anything you want to grow in, there will always be something that comes into your life to check the growth. Because there are forces that want to keep you and I from being who God has designed us to be. There are. There's issues that we have that keep us back to being normal. The last soil that Jesus talks about is the good soil. The good soil. This is the soil that is where well-placed seeds go that actually produced. If you are good soil, you actually produce. Let's relook at what Jesus said about good soil in his parable. And other seeds fell into good soil and produced grain, growing up and increasing and yielding 30-fold, 60-fold, and 100-fold. So according to Jesus, the soil isn't delineated by the color of it. It's not delineated by really much of any. I mean, there's thorns, there's different matter that's there, but really where the rubber meets the road, good soil is soil that what? What's the big word? Produces. Good hearts are those hearts that produce. Good hearts are not necessarily those hearts that go to church every week. Good hearts are not necessarily those hearts that have an emotional, warm reaction to godly stimuli. That's not a good heart. Good hearts are not linked with minds that have all the right thoughts about God. That's not a good heart. According to Jesus, good hearts, good soil, are those that produce. Give God a return on the investment of what he's given us because he's included us in his plan and to redeem and change the world and to bring lost people who are hurting into a beautiful, sustaining, eternity-altering relationship with him. And not only is it divided by who's going to produce, but Jesus says different people produce different amounts. 30, 60, 100. I don't want to go on record and say, I am managing Crossroads. I am managing my life for 100-fold investment. I am not doing my job so that people approve of what I do. I'm not doing my job to keep the rumors down. I am not doing what God has asked me to do because I need seminary professors to approve of me or other believers who have blogs. That is not the determining factor of why I do what I do in any area of my life, how I raise my kids, how I build my marriage, how I spend my recreational dollars, nothing. I want to be a part of a 100-fold increase movement. Do you want that? Of course you do. Of course you do. One thing I just, one word of, encouragement for those of us, the half of us that sat this out, actually the half who sit out financially all the time around here. What's going on? What is it that's not clicking for you and Jesus? This is a spiritual issue. I just encourage you to think about this and pray about this. This is an important thing. It's not just for the welfare of the world and the city, but for your soil, for your heart. Clues always lie in the numbers. Numbers don't lie. That's why Jesus refers to them. They're so frequently in the scriptures. If you want what the rest of the world is having, keep doing what everybody else in the world is doing. If you want the same feelings that people know, keep doing the thing. If you're satisfied with how everybody else lives their life, then just expect that basic outcome when Jesus has equipped us for a different output. One of my favorite places in the country is Lake Tahoe. I've been there once, maybe twice. And the beautiful lake, it is a lake that is 1,600 feet deep. Every day, 1,400,000 tons of water evaporate. Every day. First time I went there, a local started telling me about the lake, and he told me something I had never heard before, and I've since researched it on the internet, and I've verified it, and I'm going to try to communicate it in a way that I understand. I know some of you are more scientifically well off than I am, and I'm going to get something wrong here. But basically, it goes like this. This local said, yeah, there's a line in the middle of that lake. It's a line of demarcation. Everything above that line is one sort of water with a certain temperature, and then below that line is another with a different temperature. And then as the sun comes out and as things heat up and the earth is spinning on its axis, all kinds of different things are affecting. What happens is suddenly the lake will what's called roll over. All the water up top will roll over, and the water on the bottom will roll up. It's a rollover, if you will. It's a tipping point. It's an inversion. It rolls over. And it's just a bunch of little things. All of a sudden, click, whoosh, it rolls right over. I believe that's a principle in the spiritual realm. I believe what God does is he continues to expose us to certain things, and we learn and we grow, and then all of a sudden there's a rollover in our life. We roll over into being a kingdom citizen. We roll over into being a loving child of God that's enlisted in the family business. And as more of us come together, the areas where we are roll over. I believe we're going to see in our region a rolling over. And it's going to happen because people like you and I are serious about the amazing call that God has given us. We're serious about jumping into people's lives and developing them personally, discipling them, giving resources to areas that need funding that no one else is. Does that make you excited? It does me. It makes me incredibly excited. Incredibly excited. We're going to do a song, a couple songs together, two of my favorite songs, actually. I'm glad the music folks are going to do this. And while we do this, we're going to stand, and then we're going to have volunteers come down, and they're going to hand you out some worksheets. This is just for your personal time, your personal financial and spiritual development time outside of here, to take a look at where your money is going and what your premeditated percentage could be. What it could be. You're not going to bring those back next week. That's your personal choice. But we will give you when you come back. Actually, if people don't come back, the hard path will not come back. Happens every time. Every time we do something like this, I mean, people leave. It's like, hey, fine. You know, we're not going to cater things to hard paths. We talk to those who want to actually produce. And so next week, we're going to be able to commit a percentage, just a percentage, and it's going to be really, really good. It could be a key tipping moment, actually, for us as a church and for our city. In the book of Psalms, it says this, make your vows to the Lord, your God, and perform them. Let all around him bring gifts to him who is to be feared. We have the ability to make a vow. And some of us who just, man, we've just made so much happen around here. We give proportionally and disproportionately. God's just affirming you exactly where you are. But I believe for a great majority of us, there's a new place that God's taking us. And as a result, he's going to take our church and our city. Why don't we stand right now? Let me pray for you. God, thank you for your patience and always modeling for us what you want of your children. Help us connect with you right now and connect with you all week. Amen.